My name is Dwayne Scribner, and I am, for these 3 weeks, this is the second of three, a literature person on the in Holden Village. And my background combines the teaching of English and a great deal of work in politics and government. I'm currently a corporate public affairs person, someone who worries about government and community relations, and translating the private sector to the public sector, and on the other hand, serving as kind of an intelligence function within the corporation that translates the public sector into our corporation for whatever planning purposes that's worth. And I come to that having been through the experience of working in the office of a U.S. senator and a governor in program policy development functions. So that's the attractiveness of me to Dayton Hudson, not just my contacts, but what I know about the way that system works. So I combine those. I've been trying to combine those these 3 weeks, looking at the politics of hope in a political outside world sense as much as possible, and trying to see the relationships between what is happening, for instance, what happened in the civil rights movement, and where we are in thinking about living the politics of hope in this environment. That's what we did last week. We looked at Martin Luther King. We looked at some perspectives on social justice and what communities are like and the kinds of commitments that are made and how personal ones differ from political ones, or how they're similar mostly. This week we're moving forward into the future, not very far, because much of what we're going to be looking at is very present. And we, for literature to use as perspective on the things we're going to be talking about, I've chosen three books. And what we're going to do this morning is to talk about those in an introductory way. Hopefully, you will have read one or more, or even all of them. The purpose of our using these books is not so that you read them for the first time. If that happens, that's great. That's wonderful. But we want to talk about these books from the perspective of the kinds of insights that they provide to us on political movements and the politics of hope. So we'll be getting to that in just a few minutes. Before we do that, though, before we look briefly at those three books, I'd just like quickly to go around the room and see who you are and where you come from. And I know that some of you may never show up in this setting again, and that's all right. The discussion will stand by itself today and down the road. But all right, now I'll just repeat the invitation at the beginning, which is that it'd be neat if we were all a little over further. I've tried all over here together. I've tried to do that over in the Village Center, and unsuccessfully, because they have soft seats on some of those chairs over there. But good. All right, we'll go on. And you have no idea how much that helps to get an idea of where people are. And it is impressive to see the variety of people here. Now, we are into a theme for the summer called the Politics of Hope, and each of us on the faculty is trying to contribute to that in some way. And as most of you know, next week is Christmas, and next Sunday is Christmas, and I really hate to be dealing with negative utopias just before Christmas, but that's the way it worked out. I didn't know, and maybe it's a good perspective that will give us some sense of where we're headed. I've been trying to use literature here and political social movements to provide some perspective on that. And I need to refer briefly, especially for this week, what we're going to be really looking at this week, to a couple of things. One is this. Those of you who haven't seen it and haven't looked at it, the Global 2000 report to the president not only identifies significant trends that are underway in the world that basically we need to be concerned about as caring people, but beyond that, there is a movement, a political movement underway for almost every trend that's in here. There's an ecological movement, a social political movement, I should say. There's an ecological movement, there's a feed the hungry movement, there's an anti-nuclear movement. All of these things really fit in very well into the context that's provided here, and it's worth looking at from that standpoint. It's available in the bookstore. And then from another standpoint, which is one that I am particularly attuned to, there's a little book called The Elements of Hope, which is a whole lot of perspectives on the world around us. And you've probably heard this quoted here and there already, or you certainly will. And I think it's well worth getting and looking at to give you a general picture of what the politics of hope is intended to be all about from a Holden viewpoint. Where we are going today is to take a look at the world of tomorrow by using three books. And what we will do is look at those books very briefly today, and then we will come back to them. For those of you who want, they're all in the bookstore, and I'll tell you how many copies, very few for a couple of them, and they're in the library. And we'll come back at the end of the week for a final discussion about these three books that is called Love and Hope in 1984 and Beyond, which was really another way of getting a discussion session on these books. That will be Saturday morning. And if you can't make if you can't be there for that, please don't get up and leave now, because you will be able to follow up on it. In the middle of the week, for those of you who are interested in it, there will be another session which will use these incidentally along with some other things, which is really how to read this kind of material for perspective. It's the old English teacher in me coming out. And I'll use some other things, including a couple of folk songs and a poem or two, to try to get at some of the ways in which you can read for insight. And I must say, some of what I do in that session is very close to what Christine Carlson was doing this morning with her introduction to the Psalms. So you'll find that those of us who are looking at the religious literature and those of us who are looking at the secular literature are not all that different in our approaches. Why do we do this? It's because thinking about why do we take these strange things? Because people thinking about people like us in an entirely different structure, an entirely different environment, is a way of getting outside and looking at where we are, at who we are, and how we relate to each other as people. And I hope you will enjoy one brief passage that I'm going to read from the Martian Chronicles that really illustrates that a little later on. There are a lot of things we take for granted. And if we approach questions of politics and political movements and massive change like protesting war and Vietnam and civil rights without understanding the things we take for granted and what may happen when those things are disrupted, what kinds of problems we have, well, we run into very serious problems. If you take Martin Luther King, for example, to have gone into the civil rights movement in this country and the nonviolent confrontation that took place without understanding, without having a sense that that people might be killed, that they would be beaten, that to be a leader of people into a battle without understanding what a battle is and what it does to the relationships that we sort of take for granted among people, you know, civility and rationality and so on, is really dangerous. And so this gives us an opportunity to see worlds that are very different from ours, except they have some similarities to them that are both frightening and instructive. One of the things we have in common, besides, as people, as you are well aware, is that we spend a good deal of our time wondering about what this world is coming to. And these three books are a way of looking at what this world is coming to as well. So let's look at those books. Last week in the sessions that I did, we focused pretty much on one long book. And the record of completion of that book within the group was spotty. Nobody got through it. One person got through more than 500 of the 930 pages in the book, and 200 was more usual. But that's not the point. The point is not to take a book and read it and finish it. The point is to take a book and work in it and think through it. And those folks who started the Five Smooth Stones last week have a rich experience ahead of them, I hope, based on the several sessions that we had and the ideas that are portrayed in that book when they get back and finish it. And the only sad part of it is that they might wish they had the group back to talk to about it once they get finished. We are going to use the process of reading and thinking about these books as far as we are from time to time to help us in look toward the way we read in the future. The other thing, though, is that all these books are short. Somebody who gets through 200 pages is going to be through either Martian Chronicles or Brave New World easily and will be within 30 or 40 pages of the end of 1984. So these books are not so burdensome, yes.
What was the book you were reading last?
Five Smooth Stones, a novel by Anne Fairbairn, which is a story of a black boy born in New Orleans who gets some really favored help and grows up to become a civil rights leader. It was published in 1966 and was a big bestseller, and it, of course, really took off after Martin Luther King was assassinated. But it really tries to deal with with blackness and the black and white societies and the kind of commitments it takes. We'll be back on that next week. We can do that again in a little different way, but there will be some books available then. At any rate, you can pick it up in your bookstore back home. Many of you have read these, and that's not only okay, it's an advantage because our time is short. Our purpose is to look at ourselves through these books, not necessarily to make new discoveries of the books themselves. If you haven't read one or another of them, I recommend you pick one you haven't read. In other words, if you've read 1984 but haven't read either of these, maybe you ought to try to get hold of a copy of one of these. Or if you read the Martian Chronicles, try one of the others. There are copies of 1984 in the library, both on reserve and circulating. And in addition, there are, I think, 9 copies in the bookstore for sale. There are only 2 copies of Brave New World. They're both in the bookstore, and I don't know at this moment whether the bookstore is going to take one of them and put them in the library or not. But we're really short of those. I simply couldn't get a hold of enough of them on the short notice. And there are 4 or 5 copies of the Martian Chronicles in the bookstore. And after we've talked about them, you'll be able to make some judgments about those. What I hope you will do, since they're short, is if you get one of them and read it, first of all, I hope if you've read 1984, you'll wait a day before you try to buy it in order to give other people a chance at it. That's going to be the one we really focus on. The second is that since the book is short, maybe between today and Saturday, there could be some sharing of of those copies. Now, let's just do a quick review of each of these books, more to remind you of what they're about, interest you in them, and suggest what they may have to offer you as we look at the politics of hope this week, than to be definitive and get into literary criticism. One of the things I like about being here is that I don't have to go back to dealing with books formally in terms of their art in great detail and their structure and all of that a very important material that you do when you're a professional analyst of literature. But instead, we can get down to the gut things about these books, which is how to really read them for and get the most out of them, get the most enjoyment out of them, and get a sense of what they say. I see a book as a dialogue piece, and fiction is no different from that. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later. But let's take a quick look at these three. 1984, how many of you have read it?
Go ahead.
Okay.
A long time ago.
Yeah, right. That's fine, and you may want to refresh yourself, and the copies in the library will be enough to do that for you. You may pick it up as we go along. 1984 belongs to a kind of book called Utopia. There's a little bit in the introduction of 1984 about utopias. This book particularly, it has a new slant. It is written as a negative utopia, which means that while the utopia movement was an attempt to describe societies in which men could fulfill their perfectibility, humans could fulfill their perfectibility. 1984 is a book which says, let us look at human beings in an environment where not only where their perfectibility, where their values are really up against a challenge from a terribly repressive environment, where in fact some of the things that we dislike most, or many people dislike most and fear most about our society, become dominant. This book is set in London, but for those of you who were here last week and for those of you who know the play, in a sense, London is our town in this book. It becomes a universal environment. The world, you see, has been divided in this book up into three regions, which are constantly at war with each other. One of them is Western Europe and the United States, our bloc, the one very similar to the one we typically think of as being the West. Another one is the Russian bloc. And even though this book is written in 1948, the third one, interestingly enough, is the Chinese bloc. Very Eurasia, East Asia, and Oceania, which is us. These three regional groupings are at war with each other. And the war changes. You know, one day you're at war, which it's always 2-on-1, and the alliances keep shifting back and forth. And you begin to get a sense of what the real purpose of this warring is in this environment. This book was written before there was a nuclear bomb. Or I shouldn't say that. This book was written before what we think of today as the nuclear threat was a very dramatic. And Eric Fromm has an essay in the back of it written in 1961 in which he kind of interprets it for that. But don't read that before you look at the book. However, do go and read it if you have read the book and haven't read it before. Considering that this book was published in 1949 at the beginning of the Cold War, those three blocks are not a bad prediction of where things were going to go. All right. The other thing that's another thing that's a characteristic of this book is that it is very repressive. There is constant surveillance of everyone. This is the book from which the term Big Brother came. Big Brother is watching you is the theme of it. There's constant surveillance of everyone. The TV set has become a weapon of repression in this book, just to remind you of what was going on, that there was cable TV is a wonderful thing. Well, we see it in 1984 in its most awful manifestation. There's a constant revision of history. This, again, is a book from which the idea, that's the sense of unperson comes. You know, people are just wiped out. History is revised on a constant basis. And one of the good ways to get eliminated in this book is to make a mistake and forget to leave somebody out who's no longer in. There are three, if you remember, those of you who don't, there are three slogans of significance in this book that are repeated several times. One of them is "War is peace." Marvelous thought the week before Christmas. War is peace. Another one is "Freedom is slavery." Now there's a certain relationship between that and the traditional Christian look at being a slave of God, in a sense, which is the only way you can get your freedom. But that's very ironic in here, I think. And I don't, you know, haven't talked to George Orwell about it, so I can't tell you what's there. But you might think about that and read it in those terms. And the third is that ignorance is strength. That's the third slogan that guides the lives and the government of this community that we see in this book. This is the book also from which doublespeak comes. Doublespeak is an important concept. There's a thing on Newspeak. It's called Newspeak, actually. Doublespeak is one form of it. A little essay at the back, which you might read for fun, but which suggests how language can be manipulated in the interests of repression, related to propaganda, related to the whole idea of propaganda. And so very timely. And amid all of this, which is one of the great attractive things about this novel, and in the same sense, one of the most devastating things, amid all this, there is a love story. Julia and Winston have a forbidden love affair. And it's not forbidden for racial reasons, it's just forbidden because love affairs are forbidden in this society. And that love affair, as in almost every piece of significant literature that you will ever read, is the key to relating the environment of the novel to the values and the people and the meaning of the book. What kind of love affair can you have in that kind of repressive environment, and how would it turn out? Well, it's interesting to look at this one, especially coming off, if you have come off Five Smooth Stones or Our Town, or you're, you know, some of the things you see on television that are real reinforcements of hope and romance. You'll find this to be quite a love affair. And we're going to get into that very specifically on Saturday morning. And finally, in this book, a great deal of the oppression comes about through the use of technology of various kinds. 1984 couldn't operate without the computer, television, electronic communication, and so on. That's another element that's really important to look at here. Or what Orwell has done is to take elements that exist and are just beginning and done the thing that most people do with science fiction or future-oriented books, take those extend them out into a world that doesn't exist now, but has the potential to become like that. And he starts out with it as it is a utopian novel, because this is one of those model societies. But this is a model negative society. In 1984, therefore, suggests some things about the politics of hope that can be a fairly scary on the one hand, and I think especially when you get into this particular love story. Well, that's enough about that as an introduction. Don't read this book expecting to find yourself getting warm fuzzies on every page, because they aren't there. The second book is Brave New World. Now, Brave New World was written in 1932, and it is also a negative utopia. These two books are often described as the classic negative utopias of modern time, of this century. This was written in 1932. It's written again by an Englishman. Well, you know, really an international citizen, as it turns out, Aldous Huxley. It is another negative utopia, but this, in this book, you know, war is not the the big deal. This is a domestic utopia story. And it is a study of how you can have peace through medical technology. This is a book about the use of drugs to control people. It's a book about cloning. Remember, 1932. Book about cloning, the development of test tube babies, and, you know, producing whole collections of them that are all alike. It is a very rigid social order, but it's a very happy one for almost everybody, because they have a little pill that they take when they're on, when they're thinking about being unhappy, and suddenly they're happy again. The drug, you may remember, is called Soma, some of you who may have read it. And I will never forget, about 10 years ago, I think it was, I had a nervous, 20 years ago, I had, it's really great to have your wife in the class. I had a stomach kind of problem with some pain, and went, and, you know, it was a nerve kind of thing, and the doctor prescribed medication for that, which was a sort of a nerve control kind of thing. It was called Soma. It's no longer, as I understand it, on the market. But I thought, you know, did somebody have a? It was intended, you see, to do what Soma does. That is, it's a tranquilizer of sorts that works on your nervous system. And I was wondering where we were in our society when I read that. The slogan, there's a slogan in this book too, in this novel, and that is really characteristic, and it's called, it says, a gram is better than a dam. There are a whole lot of little slogans like that in there. In other words, you know, when you feel like cursing, take a pill. Amid all of this, and this is the thing that makes this novel worth looking at from our standpoint as people who are interested in hope and the politics of it. There's a little group of, well, they don't look like a little group at first, but they are, a little group of nonconformists, people who just reject all of these concepts, people who can't be brought into conformity with the practice of this society. And the hero of the novel is one of those people who just fight it all the way through. And that struggle, that conflict, is the key to really seeing this book. In medical terms, as we would know it, from the standpoint of that society, they are insane. And they have to be dealt with as if they were insane people. And folks, they are you and me, people with the traditional values that we share, and it's interesting to see what happens to them If you can't get a hold of this book here, it's worth reading back home, old as it is, just from that standpoint. It provides an interesting perspective on the definition of insanity, which, if you talk to psychiatrists, you will hear you will hear used. It's not foreign. It's not a, you know, a distortion of the sense of what it is to be insane in our society. All right, enough on that book. The third book is The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. And by the way, how many of you have read Brave New World? Let's start with that. Oh, yeah, several. How about The Martian Chronicles? Well, you'll have fun. How many of you read much science, what we call science fiction, at all? Well, Ray Bradbury is, I think, one of the most exciting of the people who write in the milieu of the future. He has a book called The Illustrated Man, which is a collection of short stories that just is just wonderful. And this book has some of that tradition in it. This, as you might suspect, relates somehow to Mars. And it is about a society in the future, not very far. It starts, what, about the turn of the century, about 2000, somewhere in there, 1990s. And a group of people, or various sorts of groups of people, who move from Earth to Mars for various reasons. Colonization of Mars and what happens. One second chapter of it is a neat little thing related to something we were just talking about, where these people arrive from the spaceship, walk up somebody's farm, somebody's house, and knock on the door and say, "Here we are, we're from Earth." And are told, referred somewhere else, and they go there and say, "Here we are, we're from Earth. Isn't it wonderful? We've conquered space. Here we are." Referred somewhere else, and they eventually find themselves in an insane asylum. In other words, there's a sort of a sense of what might happen to you if you came from some foreign, completely foreign world and walked into a society. This, by the way, the same thought has often been used to, you know, think a little bit about what might happen to Jesus if he showed up in our kind of society in these days, and that's one of the ways in which we get insights into here. There's a value set on Mars. This is not a utopia book exactly, but it has a lot of resemblance to it. It's a loosely knit collection of episodes that are almost stories in themselves, but they come together to ask some really serious questions about values. This is the great thing that Ray Bradbury has to offer. Everything that he does is really value-oriented. In The Illustrated Man, another book collection, there's a story, for instance, about a woman who's living alone in her house or her home and has the shades pulled all the time. Never goes out except at night. Won't have anything to do with the sunshine. And as the story goes on and you get through it, what you find out is that her husband was a space traveler, navigator, pilot, whose rocket fell into the sun at one point. And so forever for her, the sun that comes up every day and cheers us up is a repressive, just a terrible thing. She has an obsession with it, and it reminds her of her loss. Well, that's the sort of thing Ray Bradbury does in trying to take this foreign environment, these foreign environments, and get us to think about ourselves and our relationships with each other and so on. I've always thought Ray Bradbury was about three steps ahead of almost everybody else in the, quote, science fiction environment for that reason. So it has some similarity to Utopias. Sort of asks the question, If you flee earth to avoid its oppressiveness, what do you find? What do you find? If you flee your environment to look for a new one, to go for a utopia, to go for some sort of perfect thing, what do you find? You've got a group of people come together. And I'd like just to read a very short passage from the Martian Chronicles, from about the middle of it, which I hope, I know won't spoil the book for anybody, just in order to illustrate that a little bit. This is the year 2004-2005. The chapters are headed by dates, and it's called The Naming of Names. I don't know whether that suggests anything to you or not. They came to the strange blue lands and put their names upon the lands. There was Hingston Creek and Lustig Corners and Black River and Driscoll Forest and Peregrine Mountain and Wilder Town, all the names of people and the things that the people did. There was the place where the Martians killed the first Earthmen, and it was Red Town and had to do with blood. And here where the second expedition was destroyed, and it was named Second Try. In each of the other places where the rocket men had set down their fiery cauldrons to burn the land, the names were left like cinders. And of course there was a Spender Hill and a Nathaniel York Town. Those are characters from earlier in the book. The old Martian names were names of water and air and hills. They were the names of snows that emptied south in stone canals to fill the empty seas, and the names of sealed and buried sorcerers and towers and obelisks. And the rockets struck at the names like hammers, breaking away the marble into shale, shattering the crockery milestones that named the old towns, in the rubble of which great pylons were plunged with new names: Iron Town, Steel Town, Aluminum City, Electric Village, Corn Town, Grain Villa, Detroit 2. Great irony there. All the mechanical names and the metal names from Earth. And after the towns were built and named, the graveyards were built and named too. Green Hill, Moss Town, Boot Hill, Bidawee, and the first dead went into their graves. But after everything was pinned down and neat and in its place, when everything was safe and certain, when the towns were well enough fixed and the loneliness was at a minimum, then the sophisticates came in from Earth. They came on parties and vacations, on little shopping trips for trinkets and photographs and the atmosphere. They came to study and apply sociological laws. They came with stars and badges and rules and regulations, bringing some of the red tape that had crawled across Earth like an alien weed and letting it grow on Mars wherever it could take root. They began to plan people's lives and libraries. They began to instruct and push about the very people who had come to Mars to get away from being instructed and ruled and pushed about. And it was inevitable that some of those people pushed back. That gives you a sense of what it is like to colonize Mars and some other things. I'm going to we can talk a little bit more about these books and questions that you may have and some thoughts about how we might approach them. But before I do that, I just want to remind you again that on Wednesday there will be a session on reading for insight and perspective for those who want to come. On Saturday we're coming back to talk about these books. There are other things going on, of course, around here this week, and you do not need to do any of those things to enjoy these books. You ought to know that. But I want to make myself available and the rest of us available in some kind of group to follow through to the extent that you want that. And actually, I'd like even to go beyond that. Sometime tomorrow, I'm going to post a little thing on the bulletin board here, so that if there are some of you that want to get together in between sessions, can't come to the Wednesday session or the Saturday session, want to get together and talk about the book one-on-one or in small groups, I'll have a kind of schedule of time and place where we can do that, where I'm willing to be present and eager to be present and talk with you further about this stuff. So that's how we're going to proceed with this piece of it this week. Now, I've talked about three books which a great many people in this room have read. And remember that we're approaching the question of how we can get perspective on ourselves and where we are, and particularly political kinds of things from these books. And now's the time, since we have about 10 minutes left, now is the time when you can get in your digs at the beginning and help all of us see what you've already seen in these books and how it might relate. And, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of going forward and making some judgments. I must say that one of the things that I like to do most is to just sort of take something and say, doesn't this suggest? And sometimes it doesn't, you know. Sometimes it's the dumbest thing you ever heard. But once in a while, you know, once in a while something comes out of that that's a real insight and that's worth doing. So have you got some thoughts about any of these books that might be helpful to the rest of us? Yes?
A piece of advice that somebody gave me once about reading this kind of literature I thought was really helpful. You pointed out that it sometimes can get easy to think of it as a guess about the future and spend your time figuring out how well did they guess about what would turn out and where were they right and where were they wrong. But they pointed out that essentially the books are about the time when they are written, also that the issues and the value conflicts and the ideas and the struggles are about that time, and it's a piece of literature that tries to help people see themselves by taking them to the future and exaggerating present trends and so on. I found that very helpful in terms of remembering that it's about the author's own environment and not kind of a guess about a completely different other place.
That's really important insight, and it says something about the art that's involved. When you read a novel, any kind of literature, not just a novel, on the most basic level, there are two things that you need to do to make it really work for you. One of them is to be open to it. That is, you've got, you know, this is an artificial construct. It's words on a piece of paper. But as you know from watching television, you can react to it emotionally. You can get into it and you can believe that it's real. The willing suspension of disbelief or verisimilitude or all the other terms we use for what happens in literature when it gets to us and we get a sense of living it. It's a very important thing to have happen. The other thing that really, really have to do is keep your head on straight at the same time and look at it from the standpoint of what, in fact, this creator of this work is to do. That's the heart of the thing, and that's really an important comment. Yes.
You mentioned insanity, and I was just thinking about the insidious appeal of this insanity and how much the church, I think, becomes a part of that in its creation of its own utopias, call them heaven or whatever. And thinking of Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor and the Brothers Karamazov, in which he takes the temptation of Christ and recaptions it so that when Christ himself comes back to the representatives of those now invested with the authority of the church, the Grand Inquisitor questions Christ and in effect suggests that it's good to maintain the mysteries of the church. And I forgot what some of the other temptations were about, but the temptation was to allow people to think beyond for themselves and to go beyond the insanity. And yet where the church was not really wanting to permit that, and in fact was becoming a party to the appeal of such an insanity.
Yeah, I get very nervous that I've heard some of it around here this past week. I get very nervous whenever the word demonic is used. And the reason for that is very basic, I think. It's something that you reserve for those things that must really be at the extreme, because you start playing around loosely with that, and what is insane becomes demonic, and it can be applied in so many ways as we look at it as human beings. You have a comment?
I was thinking about Saturday night when we talked about prophecy and prophets in conjunction with the texts and how to define that as prophecy. And I got to thinking that in reading a book while I've been here, the comment is made that there's going to be no more water than there already is. And how, in looking at the three books, what is a prophecy and what is a foretelling? And like Dan said, it's really a chronicle or a kind of explanation of what's going on currently. And I think it all ties together in that we aren't going to probably dream up a whole lot of new ways of valuing, but we may think up new ways of mechanically living or creating life around us or moving around to other places and planets. But we're going to take our value system that's been around for millennia, no matter where we go, and it's certainly apparent in all those books.
Yes. For reasons I don't understand, I'll probably understand later on, what you said just reminded me of a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which you should also, you know, which you also might want to look at, by someone named Maynard Percy. And it deals with technology and, you know, the trends and so on. It is, in a sense, the celebration of technology and the things that it offers us. So it is important, I think, to use this kind of thing to look within the context of earlier. We're not going to do that. So how can we make the most of what's there and avoid the things that will head us in that direction? The essay at the end of 1984 by Eric Fromm really gets into nuclear war issues and so on from the standpoint of 1961, and he says in there that one of the things that you can do is look at 1984 as a warning of what might happen, what could happen, where particular things are leading us, and try to deal with them sensibly in the meantime. Good point. Yes?
One of the specific things that came to mind is you were referring to that slogan from Brave in the World, that Graham is better than a dam, is that saying of Paul Fournier when he says that neurotics are people who can't say damn, which is an interesting thought in itself, but relates to the whole matter. What do we do with our hostility toward ourselves, toward our husband, wife, children, other nations in the world? A tremendous issue involved with the handling of that. Interesting how Brave New World deals with that in terms of the medication and all the symbolic and literal meanings of that for us.
Lowell has a session this afternoon. What's it called?
A New Look at War.
Yeah, which I expect is going to have. There's going to be some relationships between that and the war and the environment in 1984, yes.
See, I was just going to pick up on Dan's there comment. George Orwell, really, when he wrote the book, his title was 1948, but the publishers told him, this is a great novel, but 1948, we can't use 1948. Here it is, 1949, it's a year.
I hadn't heard that. Terrific.
Yeah, so they just turned it around. And see, actually, we're certainly living in it. We've been revising history. We're just doing a great job of revising history in our own time. And Francis Fitzgerald documents it just beautifully and frighteningly. As far as privacy is concerned, you know, hang on to your hat with a little bit of investigation. you know, that our computers just reveal, and we can get the, I can get all kinds of information on you, you can get all kinds of information on me.
It's all good, I just want you to know.
Oh, that. Yeah, okay, so, but, you know, don't wait for 1984, it's here.
Yes. One of the things that I can't remember, I guess it's in probably both, but in the movie and also in 1984, as well as the book, was the use of weakness. And the thing that I remember most is the pressure that was put on the man through the mice, you know, and rats, okay, how the fear, and I could certainly identify, maybe because that's, I have a little fear in that area myself, but how we use and how we look for the weaknesses within people at times and try to manipulate people or to handle our world in which we live through that device of trying to psych out people and work with people and how our society does that, you know, and it's sort of a, to me it was an insight, a rather frightening kind of way in which we try to handle the world in which we live. We, whether we're talking about our presidents or just us, there's that desire within us to handle those things that we maybe don't know how to handle in either way by finding out what makes them afraid and therefore how I can use that in my relationships with people.
Yeah, the torture of Winston and Juliet, the lovers, in 1984 is very key element of a book and a love story. And we're going to get into that on Friday. I know you won't be there. We might go back and look at it again in light of the discussion. Well, it's 11:45, and we must stop. Thank you for being here today. And if you books are in the bookstore and in the library, you want to get back in them, get back, come back, and also watch the bulletin board for other opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you. That was refreshing.